This is continuing Raymond on 26 August 76.
I think he was during that run on M31. He came and visited the bungalow, all right, and sort of looked at the chart recorder, recorder sheets, but that.
Right.
I don't think he ever really took any active part in any of the observations. I don't remember that at least.
Well, let me ask about these extragalactic hydrogen observations. What was the main difficulty in the experiment?
Lack of sensitivity. We sort of started out doing it. Well, I guess the standard way by pointing at the Andromeda Nebula and scanning in frequency as we did then, and that didn't show anything or hardly anything. So then we soon decided that we needed more. I mean, the only way to overcome this lack of sensitivity was to do on-off type of measurements, and that worked rather well, but it was tedious. It took a long time.
Right.
I forgot now what the integration times were. It's probably described in the paper, but I forgot.
I think they were an hour or something like that.
Yeah.
Was there any difficulty in the calibration of the new instrument, or did that all go pretty straightforward?
That was pretty straightforward, and of course at that, for these kind of observations, it wasn't too important either, because they were very low intensities, and so it really didn't matter all that much.
Yeah. Now, you had a short paper with Volders in 57 in which you looked at M33, M51, and M81 and only detected M33.
Right.
Was this surprising at all in terms of the astrophysics, or?
No.
What was it telling you about the hydrogen mass of galaxies?
No, not really. I think that was just, I mean, that came out of that same run. I mean, I had done all the observations, but since I had to go into the army at the time, I didn't have really time to work it out. I did the work on M31 with Hek van der Hulst, and then after that I sort of quit. And so the reason my name is on that other paper is mainly because I did the observations,
right,
and that Louise Volders did the work on it.
Right.
And I don't think it was surprising at all, because that again demonstrated that we had too little sensitivity to do anything else than the most nearby galaxies.
Well, what was known at that time? Was it only the Magellanic Clouds? The Kerr?
I doubt whether that was even known.
Well, yeah, that was. That was 50.
Maybe it was.
50. Well, maybe not. Maybe that was about the same time.
So.
55, 56.
I would guess it's been done about the same time.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it had not been published at the time.
Yeah.
So I think they were definitely the very first extragalactic hydrogen observations.
Yeah. Well, no, the Australians are first, I know, but you were doing it, I think, more or less simultaneously.
Yeah. Well, but that is possible.
Yeah.
That's possible. I actually never looked into that.
That doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
On what basis were you going after? I mean, how much hydrogen did you expect? That's what I'm trying to get at. How would one go about calculating that in those days?
I guess we just extrapolated from what we knew about our own galaxy, and sort of guessed from that.
Yeah.
And
M31 being similar, of course.
M31 being similar, and as I recall, it turned out to be, at least the distribution turned out to be rather different, being more hydrogen in the outer regions of M31 than we had expected, and less in the inner regions.
Mm-hmm.
But the total amount, I guess, was rather as expected.
While I think of it, let me ask you a philosophical question. Namely, you are one of the few Dutchmen who've been trained as proper astronomers, more or less, and yet have gotten your hands dirty with really how machines work and such. And there's a rather difference in philosophy between the English groups and the Dutch, as you know,
mm-hmm.
about this. How do you think this has influenced the way Dutch astronomy has gone? The fact that it's been set up this way. Dutch radio astronomy, I mean.
I really don't know. I know for sure that I wouldn't have liked it if I hadn't had my hands got dirty that yeah. way. And as I proved later, I mean I sort of kept doing that because that's the reason why I later moved to Dwingeloo and everything.
Right.
I just wanted to be closer to the telescope. I didn't.
But this was not a typical attitude of a student.
No, it wasn't. And I don't really know why not. Although I guess it was rather heavily influenced by Oort, who did not understand technique and electronics that well, I think. But on the other hand, he trusted Muller very much, and he was really okay. I mean, Muller will take care of the technical aspect of it. Will take care of the observing,
mm-hmm.
and that sort of. I guess he sent that message through to his students also. I mean, sort of, okay. I mean, you just think of what you want to do astronomically, and you tell the guys over there, and then we'll get done. And sometime once you got your observation, you start finding out what they mean. But I mean,
right.
I mean, all kinds of minor details like calibration and all that kind of thing. Well, better leave to a few people who know about it. And that's, although I guess we did do well. I always have been rather heavily involved in calibrating both in Dwingeloo and in Westerbork, but it's probably because I just was the type of guy who,
yeah.
who
like I say, I don't think you're typical in that respect.
No, I'm not typical Dutch in that respect. No, that's definitely true. I still think that the proper attitude would be somewhere in the middle of what I would say call the Dutch attitude and the American attitude. I also don't consider it necessary that everybody comes to whatever observatory he is observing at and do all his observations himself, because
yeah.
he may do a lot of foolish things which people who are well familiar with the instrument
yeah.
might do a lot better than he can.
Right.
And I think in a lot of ways it probably is a waste of time to...
You're referring to the NREO having
yeah,
a visitor
right.
come in.
Yes, I think that definitely isn't necessary either. But I also don't like the attitude that people hardly ever come to the telescope. I mean,
right.
So
something in between.
You would
I
really,
think I would agree
you
with
you. You would really want something that would be in between the two
yeah.
systems. And I have a feeling that, for instance, with the VLA, that people will... probably tend to go somewhere in between. They'll probably have most of the observers there, but as I see it now, I mean, there are very few people in the world who can get to understand that instrument well enough that they can really do something in a short time. I mean,
right.
maybe if they come back after four or five times, they will understand.
Yeah.
And of course, there are a few people who already have a very basic knowledge, and they can do it more or less right away. But this thing is just too darn complicated to
yeah.
to grasp it all in a few days. So, well, people won't be able to do very much more than, well, they'll make up their observing list right there and then, and then get it executed. But it's not very much different from making it up at home and sending it over the telephone. I mean, it's
well, going back to what you worked on yourself, did you go back into astronomy once you got out of the military?
Oh yeah.
And when was that now?
That was in 58.
And what did you work on?
Well, actually that was the sort of the beginning of my more or less computer career. Because when I got out, we had gotten an offer. Well, as you remember, Philips was part of our... Well, there were members of the Philips Directorate who were members of the board of the foundation.
Right.
And at that time, Philips had offered us some free time on one of their computers.
I see.
To start doing some of our data reduction by computer rather than by hand.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, until then, it had all been done by hand or by sort of analog means, right, or whatever. I mean,
these great Tegan covers.
We had designed a few machines. Well, Fred Westerhout had a sort of a graph reading machine which would do some of it more or less automatically, and apply some factors and subtract some baseline and whatnot. In an analog way, rather than doing it all by hand and by calculation. But we all felt that it was sort of necessary to get to start producing things by computer. And it turned out that Whitney Shane had just arrived, and he and I got into sort of volunteer to make our observing projects guinea pig for the first computer calculations,
mm-hmm,
which was a bit of a hard way because we had, of course, everything was recorded only on recorder,
right,
paper.
Right, yeah, you had to digitize
so
it.
So that means we had to digitize it. We had quite a number of work students do that for us, but everything got punched on punch cards, but then we had to check it again because of course the students made mistakes, and so we had to go through all kinds of complicated means of reading that. Oh well, instead of doing it a complete second time, that the reading of the chart recorder, I think what we did was to get right. Okay, what we did was to get our punch cards converted to punch paper tape by means of some machine they had at some naval institute, and then read that through an analog computer which was we borrowed from somebody else again. I forgot now what. I think it was Rijkswaterstaat or somebody mm-hmm, like that, and got it all on chart recorder again. So we got back to,
and then you could just compare the.
No, and what we then did then was use Gert Westerhout's reading machine, and so ran all our original chart recorder graphs through that reading machine and wrote them on another piece of chart recorder paper, which was already written,
right,
the one which had been read back. And then we just compared graphically. So it was a big pain in the neck. But
right.
But anyway.
You could easily see punching errors this way, yeah.
That's right. We found punching errors this way, corrected them all. Finally, we wrote the program on this IBM 650. And we got the stuff reduced, and then, did a lot of work with other punch card machines later on. I mean, little machines at the observatory. And so that was sort of our first start, and in the meantime we had, of course, I mean, after all this experience we had decided, okay, this is all very fine, but we have to do something so that you don't have to do the digitizing by hand. I mean, and so then mm-hmm, we finally got into getting all our observations on paper tape rather than immediately aiming at the observatory.
Right, about when did that happen?
That must have been around 1959, 1960 or something.
That early?
Yeah, I think so. And maybe a little later, but can't be too much later, I think.
Okay.
We made a lot of mistakes there, but anyway, finally we got a sort of a routine kind of thing going. One thing we very soon found out that getting things on punch paper tape wasn't all that safe. And that paper tape punches made a lot of mistakes. You had to maintain those very carefully and get them replaced every 24 hours or something like that. And a maintenance job done on them every 24 hours and all that kind of thing. Once we got all that straightened out, it went pretty smoothly. Right.
So when you said that Philips had a computer before, it wasn't a Philips computer, it was an IBM. Right. Did you have any idea at that time how computers are essentially going to take over not just radio astronomy, but of course all of scientific reduction? This was the direction that things had to go?
I guess I never realize it in so many words, but it was very clear to me that it was the way to go, I mean, for us. And well, things sort of happened automatically after that. I mean, Latin University got a computer,
right.
And so we, the next thing we did was write a program for the Leiden computer to reduce the data, and that again had to be done. Well, we had a lot of data before the Leiden University actually got its computer, but in the meantime, well, the computer we got was this Dutch computer X1, which was the factory of which was owned by an insurance company, and.
What was the company that made it?
The company was Electrologica, the one which merged with Philips later on.
I see.
Or actually taken over by Philips, I think, right. Later on. And the insurance company offered us some time on. I mean, while we still didn't have our computer, offered us some time on their computer. So then, but we had to do all our reductions in. Time that their computer wasn't actively being used for their insurance business, so it was always at night time on Saturdays.
Right.
And of course, that was also in the day that nobody at the observatory had his own car. So, well, we had to haul all these boxes of cards and whatnot to The Hague and back, and well, we borrowed a car from ZWO for that. It was kind of curious. I would go on the train to ZWO, borrow their little car, which was a little small Austin, and get it back to Leiden, put all our boxes in it, and then go the next day with Hoekema, and just we would spend all of Saturday or something like that.
I see.
Re-cranking all our data through, and then go back again and bring that car back to ZWO.
Yeah. This was all just before Leiden got its own computer.
Yes, right. Yeah.
And what was that? What kind of computer was that?
Well, that was the same computer. This X1 Electrologica X1.
And when did they get that?
Oh, I really don't know. But
early 60s.
Must have been the early 60s. But I really don't remember what. What
that's all right.
Date exactly, but I would guess it would have been about 61 or thereabouts. But I mean, that's give or take 1 year, but must have been about that time. You can probably find out, I mean, you can probably look that up somehow.
Yeah. Although it's not that critical.
No, it's not that critical.
Let me just ask you one final question about the Benelux Cross, as it was then, was beginning to be talked about. Christensen, Hergbom,
right.
And Ericsson were in Leiden, as you know.
Right.
Was there, from the computing angle, was this seen to be a horrendous job at that time?
I don't think it was even looked at all that much as from the computing angle at all, not in the very early days.
So that was not an engineering constraint like
no,
we think of it today?
No, not at all. Hmm. At least not that I remember. I know that in the very early days of the Benelux Cross, I was only involved in the site testing, which was then still more of a political question than anything
right.
else.
It had to be close to Belgium, yeah.
That's right, it had to be on the Belgian-Dutch border, and that's which made it quite difficult to find something. And I think we were all got a relief by the time Belgium withdrew from the project,
yeah.
So they could put it someplace where we liked to put it,
right.
Rather than someplace where we had to put it because it was a joint Belgian-Dutch project. But I don't remember that the computing angle of that was a big deal at the time. I don't think it was thought of very much.
Looking back now, it would seem to be rather an oversight.
Sure, it was. I mean, it should have been, but
yeah.
Of course, a little later, it was realized that it was going to be a big problem. But on the other hand, I guess as long as the Benelux Cross was still a Benelux Cross, the computing problem might not have been that's true. That might not have been that much.
You could get by with a couple of strip charts or their equivalent in digital.
Right. So it wasn't. Yeah. Maybe it wasn't. I mean, as long as it had the cross shape, and the supersynthesis wasn't involved.
Yeah.
That's
true.
It really wasn't that bad. Maybe not to look at it from the computer angle that much.
And the decision to go to the other. Came around, I think I was talking to Jan Hergbom, 63 or 64, and then I guess he had to begin worrying about
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
All the numbers.
Well, and I guess that was sort of, it was probably sort of influenced the other way. It was probably influenced by the availability of electronic computers at that time, that you could think of it in the entirely different way.
Right.
So it was probably, as time had gone by, I mean, you could afford to design another instrument.
Right. The computers made possible.
Right.
Something that.
Yeah, that would not have been possible before.
Right.
I think that's what it was.
Well, I'm ending things just about here in the early 60s. So thank you very much.
This is the interview with Ernst Raymond on 26 August 76.